Let's turn to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. I don't know necessarily that we'll get through a chapter each week. particularly later on, probably not, because there's so much material that's in some of the prophecies. But the effort would be to try to get through this tonight without going too overly long. But if you have your book or booklet, it will be helpful. The first image after the outline is for this chapter, Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And you can see there in the outline we have our second main point in the book of Daniel. Chapter 1 was the first main point, chapters 2 through 7 the second, and then 8 through 12 is the last of the main points. This is Daniel and friends, the faithful Israelites in Gentile dominion. And so as it kind of alludes to, it looks at these four men, and particularly Daniel, of course, but the other three will come into play here in a little bit. The focus of the book is then interactions of these men with the Babylonian Empire as they have interactions with the various kings of that empire in these chapters. So that's why it's that the faithful Israelites in the Gentile domination, because it's, while some of the dreams and things that we see prophetically are in them, it's still revolving around their interaction with these Gentile kings, as we'll see here in chapter 2, as Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and he wants to find out what it is. And so we'll read through verse 6 to kind of lay our groundwork, and then I'll bring some things that I want to touch on before we get into kind of the meat of the chapter. But it says, "And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, wherewith his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him. Then the king commanded to call the magicians, and the astrologers, and the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans." That's referring to wise men, not Chaldeans in the more broader term of an ethnic group or nationality, "for to show the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac," or Aramaic. This is where we noted in our introductory stuff, the language changes from Hebrew to Aramaic, and we'll be there until through chapter 8, speaking in Aramaic, because it's primarily dealing with the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, which was their language, Aramaic, or Syriac, as we have noted here. It says, "O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation." The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The thing is gone from me. If ye will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. But if ye show the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore show me the dream and the interpretation thereof." Now, we'll get into that. I know John's chuckling. I am too, as we will see what develops with this. You know, how many of us, we know we have dreamed dreams in the middle of the night, and we wake up and we can't remember them, but we know that we had them. I mean, I have scores, probably hundreds through my lifetime. You know, I may wake up right immediately afterwards and think I've got it, and then it's gone. But you know you dreamed it. You just can't tell anybody what it was about. And other times we can tell people, you know, I had this crazy dream last night. So this isn't something that's unusual on a human level. Now, we do have God at work here, because God's given him this dream. And he's chosen to give it to Nebuchadnezzar and to open up God's plan for Israel. Under Gentile domination, and so we'll get to that here in a minute. But I want to first touch on a little issue here with reconciling dates. We have back in Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, it says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, we dated that as being 605 B.C. And we have the dates there for Jehoiakim, how long into his reign that this happened. And then we come to this chapter 2, verse 1. It says, and in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams. Now, let's back up for a moment and look at Daniel and his three friends in their training. How long were they in their training? 3 years. So if they took him in 605, and it's Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, took them, and they're in training, how is it that in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, he has this dream? And again, if we know the chapter, he's going to call on, Daniel's going to interrupt things, because the king's going to call for everybody's head. If he's in training, why would he, how does this work? Some have said, well, see, there's a problem in the Bible. There's a discrepancy here. You can't coincide this. Yes, you can. And it concerns dating of things. And so to reconcile these two, because it would seem like, well, if they were there training for 3 years, and they wouldn't be available until at least the third year of Nebuchadnezzar, but it only says the second year. And if they were in training, their heads wouldn't have necessarily had been at stake, because, you know, they're still in training. It's the higher ups that their heads are on the line. And so let's look at some things that we need to look at, kind of they're extra biblical, if you will, because the Bible doesn't tell us about this. But in the Gentile realm, and particularly here with the Babylonians, they did not count the accession year, the year that they acceded the throne or came to the throne. That's not counted. And that's 605 BC. Nebuchadnezzar will take over the throne of Babylon from his father Nabopolassar. I don't have it in my notes, and I think it's there, but anyway, takes it from his father and becomes, yeah, Nabopolassar. And so he becomes king sometime in that year, besieges Jerusalem because they've had war in Carchemish, taking over the Assyrians and the Egyptians. That ties in with some of our scriptures in Jeremiah, because he's a prophet about the time of the captivity. And if you remember some of Jeremiah, he warns them, don't go to the Egyptians. They're not going to help you. They're not going to save you from the Assyrians. They're not going to save you from this Babylonian thing going on. And yet they do, and they take Jeremiah with them, and they go down to Egypt, and they come back. Well, the Egyptians come up to Carchemish to fight against the Babylonians, and the Babylonians beat all of them. They come down, take care of making sure that Egypt's taken care of, and along the way, Israel is in the middle, so they have to take care of Israel too. But this is when his ascension year is, but this is also the year that he takes the captives. Daniel goes. His first year is then 604 BC, which is now the second year of training for these men, because they started in the previous year, so this is their second year. And then we come to 603, which is now Nebuchadnezzar's second year. Now, he's been on the throne for parts of 3 years, but it's called his second year because the year of ascension is not counted. The other thing to bear in mind with this is the Hebrew way of time reckoning, which will help you not only here but elsewhere in the Old Testament. They would count a part of a year as a year. So if if King so-and-so, whoever the name you want to put in there, ascends the throne in March of the year, come the following year, how long has he been in power? 2. Because he's had part of the first one, and then you come in after the new year, catch the second one, now he's been there 2 years, even though literally, maybe he's only been there for 8 or 9 months. But because it crossed into the new year, we've got another year to tack on, plus that partial one. You know, we tend to be more precise because we have the abilities to be more precise. And the scriptures, the Old Testament, the Hebrews were not that precise in the sense of, yeah, he was in there for 8 months. And then he had a year, and less months were needed. I mean, we see that as we come to the end of some of the kings. They're only there on the throne for a year, or they're on for 6 months. Well, now we're being a little more precise because they didn't span a year. So there is some preciseness, yet not when it comes to those larger numbers, because they'll pick part of a year, and that would hold true for the end of the time too. The king dies in May, and he started back in May of another year farther back, they'll tack on an extra, what we would think as an extra year. We would take it from May to May being a year, then May to the next year being a year. They're going to take it May to December, there's 1 year. January to December, there's another year. He dies in April of the following year. He's been in there for 3 years. Even though chronologically, he hasn't made it to 2 years. Follow what I'm trying to depict here? So they'll take it as a part of a year regardless of how little or how big it is and count from there. So when you start looking at some of the kings and trying to do some of your chronology that you may want to do and time count, you've got to be careful with that. And I realize I'm getting a little off with the kings, but some of those kings, the father and son, will be co-regent. They'll reign at the same time for a part of time. And so there's an overlap of, let's say, a year on both sides. One off of the departing king, one on the new king, because they were co-regent. They were co-reigning. But we have these distinctions, if you will, for figuring out years, numbers. So there is no discrepancy between Daniel 1 and Daniel 2 when we understand that the year of ascension isn't counted. And so when we follow then the Chaldean way of counting, we're in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, which is actually the third year. And so has Daniel and his three friends had time to be trained? They have. And to be part of this group of magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, Chaldeans, because they've been trained in these ways. So I wanted to touch on that, bring that up to us, that it's easily to be reconciled based on how the Chaldeans counted their years for their kings. But as we look at this, we have some accusations here, verses 1 through 23, against these wise men. Because the king has a dream, and he doesn't remember it, and he's called in his wise men, tell me the dream and the interpretation. Something that's never been asked before. So let's pick it up in verse 7 and find this. We have this challenge from the king. Tell me, and you'll be richly rewarded. Verse 7, they answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it. The normal way of doing things, as they will say. The king answered and said, I know of certainty that ye would gain the time because ye see the thing is gone from me. You're trying to cover up. You're trying to work things out to your betterment. But if ye will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you. For ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me, till the time be changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that ye can show me the interpretation thereof. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, "There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requireth, and there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." For this cause the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. Now, the normal practice, and we know this from Joseph in Egypt. Pharaoh had a dream. The baker and the butler had dreams. And they told Joseph the dream and wanted the interpretation. And Joseph was able to give it to them. That's the standard practice amongst the astrologers and magicians and everybody. You tell me what the dream is, and I'll be able to tell you what it means. And so this group is saying, "King, you're asking something that nobody else has asked. This is not how this works. You tell us the dream, and then we tell you what it means." But Nebuchadnezzar wants to get beyond the manipulating. Because what does that do to the wise men? What kind of position are they in? Under the normal circumstances, I see the bad. Yeah, they're in a bad position now, but under the normal circumstances, they can be deceptive. I mean, let's give the king what he would like to hear for an interpretation of this. I mean, because you remember, we're talking, you know, these are lost people. These are not Christians, they're not Jews, they're not believers. They quickly find themselves in a position of having power over the king. He wants to know what the dream means. Let's make this favorable. They become advisors. And as we see in elsewhere, they become yes men just to appease the king to help him. We see that with Ahab when Jehoshaphat comes up and they say, you know, "Hey, Jehoshaphat, can you help me out fight these people?" "Well, sure. Gather your prophets and let's hear what God says about this. Should we go out?" And those false prophets said, "Oh, yes, yes, go ahead, king. You're going to win this battle. Go for it." And Jehoshaphat said, "No, we really need a prophet." "Oh, but Micaiah, let's not go down that road. He doesn't tell me what I want to hear. He's always saying things against me. So, Jehoshaphat, it's interesting. He wants to hear from him, but then he doesn't follow him. Because Micaiah tells him what's going to happen. And Jehoshaphat, the supposedly good, godly king of Judah, still goes along with this. Something's wrong here. But we see that these people can become advisors, can become influential then within the political realm, even though they're in the religious realm, the mystic realm. And Nebuchadnezzar is cutting that out. He's finding out their realness in their field. He wants that. "I don't know the dream, but if you tell me it, then I'll know it. Which I'll also know then your interpretation will be correct." And they're saying, "Nope, we can't do this." And so as we see, they gather Daniel and his fellows because they're part of this group. Now, they weren't here when they were called, which is interesting. But they weren't. Again, they are Jews in Babylon. So even though they were smarter than these men, as we saw at the end of chapter 1, I'm sure they were still held out at arm's distance You're not Chaldean. You're not of our group. Yeah, you went through college, okay. You passed all those courses. You did really well before the king, but you're not really one of us. And so I have a feeling they were held at arm's length within this group. They're not called, but they are now. Then verse 14, then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? Why does he want our heads all of a sudden real quick? What have we done? He answered, then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. And so Daniel goes to the king and lets him know, hey, we'll tell you. Give me time. Let's talk. Give me time. Verse 17, then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire the mercies of God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, self-preservation, number one. King, we will get you the answers that you want, but give us time. Come back to talk to his friends, guys. We need to talk to God. We see so many places in the scriptures when people are in these interesting hard spots, where do they go? To God in prayer. May we take from their example. Daniel goes to God in prayer. Why? Because he knows God can answer what he needs. God can show him what the dream is and what the interpretation is. Why? Does Daniel know about Joseph in Genesis? Sure he does. He's a godly young man. He knows his Hebrew history. He knows that God gave Joseph the understanding of dreams over 1,000 years before. Because he's read it. He's heard the stories. He knows the God of Israel can do this. So there is no hesitation on his part. He's confident, not in himself, as we will see, but he's confident in his God. God can give us this. This is nothing to God. So guys, let's go to prayer. Verse 19, then the secret was revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness and in the light, and the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee, God, and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me now what we desired of thee. For thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. And so he also turns around and thanks God for it. May we not forget that aspect of thanking God when he answers prayer. Often we are like the 9 lepers who walk away and are cleansed, and we never turn around and say thank you. May we be like the one who was a Samaritan and turn around and thank God when we see him answer prayers. Come back and thank him for that. And Daniel does so and has that prayer of thanksgiving. So now he brings the answer from the Lord to Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, therefore Daniel went in unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus unto him, destroy not the wise men of Babylon, bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste, and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king hath demanded cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king. Those guys can't do it. But, that three-letter word again, but there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. So he's already giving him a little of the interpretation. King, God's given you a dream of those things that are going to happen in the latter days. Thy dream and the vision of thy head upon thy bed are these. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed that should come to pass hereafter. And he that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sake that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. The image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them in pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. And so he says, King, you've seen an image, a huge, terrible image. And so we have that depicted there in the booklet. A head of gold, a chest of silver, loins of brass, legs of iron, and then these feet, part iron, part clay. And then this stone is cut out of a mountain, and no hands cut the stone out, and this stone hit this image on the feet, and it ground it to powder. It destroyed this image, and that rock just grew and filled the whole earth. Took it over. Interesting imagery. But God has a meaning for it, as we've already noted. And so now he's going to help give the interpretation, the meaning of it, the answer of the Lord, in acknowledging that God alone is the one who reveals these things. God, Daniel gives credit to God and God alone, which we should do as well. As God answers prayer, as God meets our needs, who did it? God did. Now, he may use other people in our lives to bring that about, but God ultimately is the one that did it. And may we always give him the glory and the honor for that. But we see the answer from the Lord and acknowledging these things. And so we look at verses 36 through 45 for the interpretation. Okay, so we have this. This great and terrible image, and then it's destroyed. What does this all mean? Let's find out. Thou, O king, art a king of kings. Verse 37. For the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power and strength and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. So we understand the head of gold is the Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar, you're the head. Your kingdom, that glorious kingdom of Babylon, it's of gold. After thee shall arise another kingdom, inferior to thee. That's why it's silver. Even in their day, gold was much more precious than silver. Still is to this day. Still precious, but not quite. That after thee an inferior kingdom, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. For as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these things, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it the strength of iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in these days, in the days of these kings, referring to the ten toes, shall the king of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So we have, again, in that full sheet that Larkin has drawn, which helps us see the rest of the book, we have this image of showing these four coming kingdoms, actually five, including the stone, but these five earth or four earthly Gentile kingdoms in succession, having different characteristics, thus the different types of metals and things used. And we have always, and I say always, I'm sure there are fringe places that come up with some other ideas. But within the conservative, evangelical, normal understanding of the scriptures, the head is Nebuchadnezzar in the Babylonian kingdom. It marked an interesting time in that day. Again, looking at how they ruled, they ruled with a rod of iron in a sense, but as we saw, they inculcated the conquered people, trying to amalgamate them and make them part of the kingdom. The Assyrians never did that. The Egyptians before them never did that. Babylon did. Babylon is home to the Hanging Gardens. That was one of the ancient wonders of the world. It was magnificent. A head of gold, truly. We see with the arms, the breast and arms of silver, the Medo-Persian Empire, which will come after the Babylonian Empire. We'll see them enter the scene here in a couple chapters. Not quite the same as Babylon. Not as picturesque, not as grandiose. Thus it's silver. We'll see otherwise. It's a dual empire, but the Persians will have more influence than the Medes do. And we'll see that depicted in coming visions and images. The belly and thighs of brass, the Grecian Empire. The legs of iron, the Roman Empire, the Roman Kingdom, if you will. And stronger than any of the others. That's why it's depicted as iron. When we look at these kingdoms and look at their rule and the vastness and how it was done, iron certainly is a good depiction for Rome. Very strong. And held itself. We see the division, if you will, with the two legs, with the eastern and western elements of the Roman Empire later on in their time. And then a changing of this, and as I think on your in the booklet, the picture for it shows Rome 1 and Rome 2, showing us the last of the Roman Empire, if you will, when Christ comes back to set up his kingdom. That's the stone made without hands. That's God's kingdom. That's the millennial reign. And when God sets up his millennial reign for Christ to rule and reign from the throne of David, all aspects of Gentile domination over Israel will be eradicated. This is the theocracy that God has always wanted established for mankind. And they had the opportunity, but Adam sinned. God called out the Israelite people, a people for his name, wanted a theocracy with them. They said, no, we want an earthly king. God's plan is going to unfold. And that theocracy will be put in place. And all that we've had before then will become ancient memory. Because God will be ruling and reigning over this earth in righteousness and holiness as he has intended it to be with Christ as king. And that kingdom fills the whole earth. It's not just over Israel. Christ's kingdom, yes, ruling from the throne of David, is over the whole world. And so we see this progression, if you will. And so what do we have as we close out the chapter? Nebuchadnezzar is in agreement. Yes, that's my dream. Now that I've heard it, yes, that's it. I'm sure like any of us would be. I know I had that dream. And I know if something will touch it off, then I'll remember it. But usually it doesn't, and so we've lost it. But Nebuchadnezzar sees, and so he falls in verse 46. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him. The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret. I told you, we're going to see a progression with Nebuchadnezzar. And it is because of his interaction with these four men, Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, and their willingness to live for God in a heathen land, regardless of the consequences. And this is the first step. Nebuchadnezzar is the ruler. He's the emperor, if you will, of the known world of his day. What he says goes. If he wants your head off, you know, your head goes off. If he wants to spare you and promote you, he can do so. He's the sovereign ruler. What he says goes. He has many gods in Babylon. But he notes, Daniel, your God, he's something else. Now, he's not acknowledging him as the one true God, but God's gotten his attention. First step. He's willing to acknowledge Daniel's God is there's something about this God that is real, that is true. Because he just did this. He gave Daniel the dream and the interpretation. So he notes this, and so he promotes then Daniel. Verse 48, then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. Then Daniel requested of the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. And so these four men are now promoted within the Babylonian Empire. Daniel over the province, the area around Babylon, the city. We could think of it as a state or county. Babylon, the empire, is much bigger. Daniel's over this, his three friends over a smaller area within the province of Babylon. But they're promoted. They're put into this position. Daniel's promoted over these men that couldn't answer to anything. Is that going to go over very well? No, it won't. And we'll see that as we go on in our studies of this. But we see the opening chapter. It sets now the tone. It sets the unfolding. Everything else that comes has to do with this image and aspects of it, of these four Gentile kingdoms that are of the latter days, which I didn't say it then, but if it started in 605 BC, when did the latter days start? In 605 BC or 603. So the latter days we often think of as being our days. I think it's John who says we are in the last days in one of his epistles at the end of the first century. God notes it here that the latter days start really all the way back here, because it starts with this Gentile dominion over Israel. When Judah is taken into captivity, is there an Israel nation? No, it's gone. Gentiles rule over Israel. And to some extent, they still do. You say, but Israel's a nation. Yes. By whose power and authority is Israel a nation? On a human level. The Gentile world, the United Nations, the nations of the world in 1948 who said, yes, the Jews can have a nation in that part of the world. The Gentile powers still have sway over the Jews. But that will change when Christ sits on his throne, because those Gentile powers will be gone. And so he's laid out this panorama, if you will, of world history in this image. Now, as we go through the rest of the book, we're going to look at aspects of it with the various visions and things that we're going to see depicted later on in the book. But now that we've got this done, we're going to focus back on these four men and look at them a little more closely, if you will, in the next couple chapters. So we'll see them in their relationship with Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, his grandson, as we go progress further into these chapters. So we've got our panorama set up. Now we'll narrow it in and look at some specifics as we get farther in.